My guest today, Robert Perry, is an investigative journalist, best known for his role in breaking many of the Iran-Contra affair stories for the Associated Press and Newsweek, for which he was awarded the George Polk Award for National Reporting in 1984. He's the author of America's Stolen Narrative and has been the editor of Consortium News since 1995. And we've had him as a guest here on Takes on the World before. So I want to welcome once again Robert Perry to Takes on the World. This past month, you've had two articles in the Consortium News site about issues in the Democratic primaries that have been ignored by the mainstream media as well as supporters of both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And I'd like to discuss these with you today. The first deals with the fact that both Clinton and Sanders have accepted the media and political establishment's groupthink on U.S. foreign policy. And the second, which we'll get to later, is Hillary Clinton's embrace of the neocons. Let's start with the groupthink. How is this playing out?
Well, neither Sanders nor Clinton has made much of an effort to talk about foreign policy. The Democratic campaign is focused much more on domestic issues, particularly Sanders trying to keep the focus on income inequality. Former Secretary Clinton has made allusions to foreign policy, mostly in the context of her experience. But they haven't really gone into much of the nitty-gritty about how they would approach some of the foreign issues that the country faces, beyond rather much the boilerplate that they would stand up against terrorism and so forth. But so what we've seen is, and we've also seen when they've been in these debates, responding to questions from mainstream reporters and correspondents, they've tended to sort of go along with the overall groupthink that there are certain enemies. They accept certain events as real when they're very much still in doubt. For instance, when they talk about Syria, they accept the demonization of Bashar al-Assad and accept that he carried out the sarin gas attacks back in August of 2013, when that is now very much in doubt. The more recent evidence suggests that it was carried out by one of the radical jihadist groups with an effort to blame it on the Syrian government and to induce the United States to intervene on their side, in effect, by attacking the Syrian military in retaliation for so-called crossing the red line. So instead of any kind of thoughtful analysis of pointing out the weaknesses of some of these groupthinks that continue to dominate Washington, Biden and Clinton tend to sort of slide behind accepting these what everyone knows to be true situations. And that, of course, gets back to what happened during the Iraq War, going into the Iraq War, the assumption that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, which was a big part of what led Hillary Clinton, then a senator, to vote for the Iraq War. Of course, Sanders at least had the wisdom at that point to oppose going to war in Iraq, mostly because he thought it would be counterproductive and that it would end up causing more trouble than it was worth. And certainly has been proven out on that point. But still, there's this attitude of not wanting to engage on issues where the mainstream media has jumped to a conclusion and where the State Department and other institutions of the government have sort of pushed a line. There isn't much thoughtful, critical thinking. There was a reference that Secretary Clinton made to the plane being shot down in Ukraine in 2014, blaming it on the Russians, when, again, that's another point that's in very much dispute. Some of the more recent evidence suggests that the U.S. has been withholding what it knows about these events, that event, and that it might well have been some element of the Ukrainian government involved in shooting down the plane. But these are cases where everyone who's in Washington who is supposedly knowledgeable jumps to a conclusion, and then when the facts come in, they're essentially shoved aside. Oddly, one of the rare times when that hasn't been the case was the case of Iraq's WMD, because that was such a high-profile issue, and it was proven to be so wrong that the U.S. government, through the CIA and other institutions, came out publicly and said what the U.S. government had claimed wasn't true. But more often than not, those kind of false claims or dubious claims are just left there. They're left there to sort of corrode the public debate. And we have not seen any real interest on the part of either candidate either leading candidate for the Democrats to challenge that kind of groupthink.
Well, it seems that Clinton is almost part of those who have made that policy, where Sanders seems to be even reticent to think critically about foreign policy. He spoke, and you mentioned your article, after Clinton's faulty analysis of the Middle East and situation in Syria and Iran, he said he generally goes along with that. And then he has the illusion that the Saudis and Qatar should become more involved in Syria, failing to understand or knowing it, the fact that their involvement in Syria is one of the problems in Syria.
Right. Basically, as Vice President Biden blurted out a couple years ago, and as the Defense Intelligence Agency has reported in one of their intelligence reports that came out, that the U.S. government knew, as known really for years, that the main elements of the Syrian opposition are the jihadists, and that the United States has knowingly allowed the Saudi royal family and the Qataris and the Turks and others to aid some of these extremist jihadi groups as a weapon to bring about regime change in Syria to overthrow the relatively secular government of Assad. Now, that's sort of, if one actually studies this, that's now known. But it's something that the Washington Press Corps, the National Press Corps, doesn't want to deal with because it's kind of, it's one of these unpleasant realities that occasionally will be touched on by the New York Times and others, but is mostly sort of pushed aside because the idea is that the U.S. always supports the good guys. And since now it's clear that some of these jihadists who've been getting American help, somewhat indirectly through the Turks or through the Saudis or the Qataris, that these folks are associated with Al-Qaeda and in some cases with the Islamic State, which of course was a spinoff from Al-Qaeda. So there's a unwillingness to recognize that the biggest part of this big problem the United States is now facing in Iraq and Syria is being driven by Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey. These are U.S. allies, supposedly close U.S. allies in the region. So what Sanders has been, his sort of talking point when it gets to this issue is, well, we need to get the Saudis and the Qataris to put skin in the game, as he said during the last debate, or get their hands dirty. Well, the point is that they've gotten their hands very dirty, and there's lots of skin in the game. But it's really on the side of supporting what you might call their paramilitaries. And their paramilitary forces are Al-Qaeda, to some extent the Islamic State, and groups like Ahrar al-Sham, which is fights hand in glove with Al-Qaeda in Syria, and has received TOW missiles and other sophisticated American hardware to carry out attacks against the Syrian army, working side by side with Al-Qaeda. So what you really have is this Sanders sort of playing a kind of a clever talking point. You know, the rich guys in the region ought to do more, but what they're doing is not helping to fight ISIS or helping to fight Al-Qaeda. It's been on the other side. They've actually been helping those extremist groups. So Sanders is playing, he's just trying to, I think, finesse the issue rather than address it. And I think that certainly has created kind of a muddled sense of Sanders in terms of how he would approach this region. And it, in a way, has helped Hillary Clinton, who at least can say, well, I have lots of experience as Secretary of State and so forth, although what she also doesn't add is that she has been part of this problem. of essentially being so determined to have regime change in some of these countries, going back to her support for the Iraq War, but also her key involvement in the Libyan conflict, where, again, in that case, the neocons and the liberal interventionists, but mostly the liberal interventionists, who I would put Hillary Clinton in that group, they pushed for a regime change in Libya. And what has occurred since then, after getting rid of this fairly secular dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, and having him killed, has been to turn Libya into a failed state, where, again, the jihadists have gained enormous areas of control and influence, where we're now seeing Coptic Christians having their heads chopped off on beaches, where we're seeing essentially this disorder and chaos that has now spread into Libya, which was not in chaos. And what we've seen in all these regime change schemes, as clever and as supposedly morally pure as they are, is that the end results are to spread violence and chaos and death, and not just in the Middle East anymore. The remarkable achievement, if you want to put it that way, of these regime change strategies is to destabilize Europe. And I would have said, if you told me a few years back that the neocon liberal interventionist strategies would start tearing apart Europe, I would say, oh, that's going too far. But we're now seeing it happen. Chancellor Merkel is in political trouble in Germany because she's allowed 1 million Muslim refugees from these conflicts to be resettled in Germany. We're seeing the European Union starting to split apart because some of the countries don't want to accept Muslim refugees. So what you're facing is a terribly failed strategy, which the neocons push mostly, but they've also been joined by these liberal interventionists who basically operate side by side in official Washington. The neocons will excuse what they're doing as, oh, we're promoting democracy. The liberal interventionists will often say, oh, what we're doing is promoting human rights. But effectively, they end up supporting the same policies. And we've seen the impact. It has not been to promote democracy, as it's turned out, and it's not been to promote human rights. What has happened is we now have these extremist jihadist groups taking over much more of these countries and taking over, having their caliphates now, and we've seen death and destruction, horrible human rights atrocities follow these policies. So it's instead of addressing these kinds of difficulties and why these strategies haven't worked, the Democratic candidates have essentially punted. They've not really been pushed on it, and they haven't really wanted to engage on it beyond Sanders pointing out that he voted against the Iraq War and that's Clinton voted for it, but they don't really get much beyond that.
Well, my guess is Robert Perry, we're speaking about our Democratic candidates and their foreign policy weaknesses. Sanders evidently voted for intervention in Libya, so he doesn't bring that up. But that Libya on top of Iraq, with all those conventional weapons, they flew from Libya to Syria and also into Chad and Africa and to Mali, some of those arms at Boko Haram. That the whole war and the series of U.S. interventions of regime change had literally destabilized that half of the world.
Right, and we've seen the consequences not being positive. It's not like a creative destruction, if you will. This has been just destruction, and it's also allowed. And this is an interesting point about. There were some of the emails that came out recently at the end of the year Secretary Clinton's email cache, and some of them were written by a longtime advisor, Sidney Blumenthal, who's a very smart guy and had pretty good connections in Europe on what was really happening. And one interesting email that he sent her dealt with what was really behind the French interest in pushing for the Libyan regime change. And it wasn't anything about human rights. It wasn't that Gaddafi was a bad guy. It was that Gaddafi was trying to use Libyan money to create a greater independence on the part of African states from French control. As you remember, France was a major colonial power in Africa and has tried to maintain that sort of neo-colonial influence, having the franc used as a peg for much of the currencies and having it be something that is that is used as an African currency that strengthens French both political and economic influence. Now, so Blumenthal describes in this email, quite frankly, why the French President Sarkozy was interested in getting rid of Gaddafi, and it was really about maintaining and solidifying French control. Gaddafi had this idea of using Libyan money to create essentially an African currency, which would have allowed the Africans to have greater prosperity and greater freedom from European control. So a lot of these events that are dressed up as, oh, we must intervene because so-and-so is going to kill civilians. And I'm not saying all that is entirely false, although often it's wildly exaggerated. There is often this other element. Much like in the case of the Iraq War, President Bush tried to sell it to the American people on the basis of Iraq having WMD and threatening us with his Saddam Hussein threatening us with his WMD. That wasn't really what that war was about. In fact, there was no WMD. It was an effort to sort of start doing this regime change strategy, which the neoconservatives had laid out as really by the mid-90s, when they sort of lay out their idea that they're tired of having these negotiations with the Palestinians. This is after Oslo, the Oslo Peace Agreement in 95. It's after Rabin has been assassinated in Israel. So the peace element in Israel has been sort of badly damaged. Prime Minister Netanyahu is sort of moving to the fore with a much more aggressive approach, rejecting negotiations. And that's when the neoconservatives, a number of key ones like Richard Perle, go to work for Netanyahu. And they produce this very important document in 1996 about how to protect the Israeli realm.
The clean break, yes.
The clean break. It says to heck with this idea of negotiations, let's just do regime change. And they start laying it out. First we'll do Iraq, then we'll do Syria, and then Iran is on the list. So they have their minds by the mid-90s that they have to, the way they're going to solve the problems for Israel and get rid of Hamas, get rid of Hezbollah, and so forth, is to take out the countries that have been supporting them. That's what they begin to do. And then when you get to 2003, after 9/11 has created this confusion and anger inside the U.S. public, that anger is then directed at Saddam Hussein, who had nothing to do with 9/11. It was really more a Saudi problem. But the public is confused, and it wants to support the president, and he's telling us that Saddam has this WMD, and he's giving it to al-Qaeda, et cetera, all made up. The more realistic reason was that the neoconservatives wanted to implement this strategy they had of putting in malleable leaders in each of these countries. Now, the trouble was that it doesn't go that simply. It may sound great at a think tank, at a conference, to say, well, we're going to do it here. We're going to take this guy out, put in someone like Chalabi and to be president of Iraq. But when it turns out, as these things actually unfold, the U.S. government can't control things to that level, even when it's occupying a nation. People fight back. They start killing American soldiers. You always can't pick the leader you want. It's someone else maybe you don't like that much has enough power to get in. So what you end up with is much more chaos, and that has continued to spread. But the neoconservatives never were punished. They never were held accountable. They continue to remain in power in Washington, and they work closely with the liberal interventionists who really joined with them in 2003, if you remember. It wasn't just the neocons. It was also people like a Bill Keller from the New York Times or many of the writers for the New Yorker magazine or Christopher Hitchens, this lefty. they were very much in support of the invasion of Iraq. There are only a handful of us in Washington who were saying, "What are you doing? You know, this doesn't make any sense. The evidence isn't that good." But we were sort of brushed aside. Some of the realists, so-called realists, these traditional American political foreign policy thinkers, were brushed aside. People like a Brent Scowcroft and people of that group. So you had the neocons and the liberal interventionists seizing control of U.S. foreign policy and implementing these dangerous strategies. And after they were proven to be wrong in Iraq, there was virtually no accountability. They weren't kicked out. They weren't humiliated. They just went on. And they continue to this day to be the dominant force for American foreign policy. And that's one of the reasons I think you don't really see on the Democratic campaign a lot of rethinking. Some of the Democratic base has begun to understand some of this. And obviously it's a factor in why Secretary Clinton's had trouble because of her vote on Iraq. But there really still isn't a broad enough understanding of how dangerous and how really stupid many of these policies were, and understanding how they all evolved into the mess we now see.
Well, it's interesting. The 2006 congressional election was a rejection of the war, put the Democrats in control of both the House and the Senate. And here was an opportunity to actually call people to account over the Iraq War. And Charles Schumer, I believe, was in charge of the U.S. Senate campaign, and Rahm Emanuel was in charge of the House campaign. Both of them very strong supporters of Israel. And then we have Nancy Pelosi, who announced there'd be no investigation about the origins of the Iraq War. So here was the Democratic Party officially covering up for the Iraq War, and we've seen the legacy of that. I mean, there was no accounting, and you know, as you mentioned, no accounting for the neocons who could have been called to attention there. I remember people said, oh, the neocons have now fallen out of favor, but they certainly haven't. You have the Council of Foreign Relations, Elliot Abrams, putting out his weekly criticisms of U.S. policy on Iran. You have
Max Boot is also, that's the CFR.
Yes.
You have groups like Brookings Institution, which people consider sort of center-left. They went out and recruited Robert Kagan to be, you know, another one of the founders of the Project for the New American Century. And if you look at the op-ed pages of the major newspapers, they're still dominated by many of the same neocons who were getting us into the war in Iraq. Fred Hyatt is the editorial page editor of the Washington Post. He was in that same position in 2002 and 2003, and was writing in the Washington Post editorial page as a matter of flat fact that Saddam was hiding his weapons of mass destruction. It turns out to be wrong. You would think, well, maybe they would fire this guy. I mean, how many American soldiers died? 4,500 American soldiers died. Maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe a million Iraqis died. $1 trillion is wasted. You might think that the Washington Post would say, gee, Mr. Hyatt, you might want to take a golden parachute and land somewhere else. No, he's still in the exact same position as editorial page editor of the Washington Post. Bill Keller, who was the New York Times, he was back in 2002, and when he was rallying the so-called liberal hawks, as he put it, to support the war in Iraq based on the WMD nonsense, he was a columnist at that time. He was writing for the New York Times magazine. But then Hal Raines, who was the executive editor, has a problem because he believes some reporter who was making stuff up, so that's a huge problem, and so they fire Raines, and they bring in to the top job of the New York Times executive editor Bill Keller, who had been completely wrong on something much more important than trusting some dishonest reporter. He'd been trusting a very dishonest government. But so there was not only was there no real accountability. In fact, it went almost the other way. people were rewarded. You were showing, now you were, you'd proven your mettle by having supported the Iraq War. And this was true in the news organizations. It was true in the political field. It was true in the think tanks, which are very important in Washington. So you end up with this situation that instead of accountability, the rewards and punishment system is upside down. And then you get the fact that the Iraq War may have been the greatest foreign policy disaster the United States has ever engaged in. And it's still playing out in very bloody and dangerous and costly ways. Yet, there has not been a serious congressional inquiry into how it happened. Who did what?
And there hasn't been demand for it. That's another thing that by the anti-war movement that existed before the war evaporated. And even,
well, but you know, some of us have been asking for it, but I mean, I guess not enough. But still, it's such that it's remarkable. Even in the United Kingdom, where they have supposedly even a greater government secrecy than we have, there have been at least some efforts to have hearings. They've called former Prime Minister Blair to testify and so forth. So they've had at least, I wouldn't say a very thorough review of this, but they've had a review of it. In the United States, nothing like that has happened. It's remarkable in this country that purports to be the gold standard of democracy in the world that there has been no serious examination of how something as deadly and costly as this occurred. There would be no hearings where they call President Bush or Vice President Cheney or then NSC advisor Elliot Abrams or any of these people to be asked, how did this happen? Who did what? And then also declassify many of the documents. We have not seen any systematic effort to do that. And it's continuing to have very serious repercussions for how the United States functions in the world. We are, as a citizenry, we are almost going blind into the future because we have been given no thorough, serious examination of how we got here in the first place.
Well, one answer for that silence might be the role that the Israel lobby and its think tanks played in producing that war. I mean, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt wrote a book on the Israel lobby, and even Amy Goodman, and blaming Israel, saying it was a war for Israel, and even Amy Goodman wouldn't interview either one of them on Democracy Now! To ask to make their case. What role do you think the Israel lobby played in keeping not just the war, but maintaining the silence, restraining the criticism of those responsible?
Well, you know, it's certainly been a factor. I think if one went to the heart of this, went back to how the neoconservatives developed their strength and why people listened to them, a lot of people would look bad. I mean, it would not just be the Israeli lobby, though. You'd have to go back to President Reagan and his role in credentialing many of the neocons. You know, I was in the 1980s, I was covering... Then the hot spot was Central America and later became the Iran-Contra scandal. But, you know, I was dealing with some of these young neocons, an Elliot Abrams or a Bobby Kagan. These were guys who were being brought in by President Reagan and given positions of influence and power. And they also had people, there were many other people, Bud McFarland, for instance, was essentially a neocon. You had Paul Wolfowitz. And if you go back to some of the records now available at the Reagan Library, you can see how they were trying to get control of some of these key areas. Those two, last two, focused on getting control of the Iran policy because at that point Israel was siding with Iran during the Iran-Iraq war. Israel was providing a lot of weaponry to the Iranians. So there was a desire among the neocons to sort of bring the Reagan administration closer to that position, being less favorable to Iraq, more favorable to Iran. And we saw some of that play into what became the Iran-Contra scandal. But so you have the neocons even then trying to position the U.S. government in a way that was basically hand in glove with the Israeli policies. And you saw that become even closer, I think, when you get to the mid-90s. And as I mentioned, after Rabin's assassination and the Oslo Peace Accord, the right-wing elements in Israel became dominant through basically through Netanyahu. And the neocons, American neocons, were working on his campaign and laying out these ideas for the, you know, using regime change. So you would have to probably, if you were going to do a thorough review of the what happened with the Iraq War, you would have to go into some of the Israeli influence. But you'd also have a lot of other people who would be embarrassed, including Democrats who went along with this for political reasons. But certainly more than that, the Republicans who were the engines for it. It would embarrass also the mainstream media quite a bit, I think. So, you know, I think these are powerful influences inside Washington. So the decision was basically, let's just not go there. Let's just pretend, just move on. Pretend like it didn't happen exactly, even though we're still living with the consequences. We'll just leave it for the historians. That's a phrase they love in Washington. We'll leave it for the historians. But the historians, of course, don't have the benefit of an investigation that's done in real time. The best investigations are ones that are done very much shortly after something occurs. And we've seen this. You know, even going, you know, go back to World War II with the reviews of what happened at Pearl Harbor and so forth. The best inquiries are the ones done even in difficult moments, relatively close to the events, because people are still fresh in their minds. You know, you have people. Some people end up getting old or dying, can no longer be questioned. Sometimes documents, even when they become declassified many decades later, aren't clear because they require some interpretation, and the people who can interpret them aren't around anymore. So what you really need to do is do it in real time. Instead, we have this sort of approach in Washington now, which is just to sort of say, oh, let's just move on. Forget that. Deal with the future, not the past, I guess is how. But the trouble is that the future is often driven by the past. And if there's no accountability for the people who caused the troubles in the past, those same people are around to cause troubles today. And we're seeing that happen again. And policies have been carried out even under the Obama administration, where the neocons and liberal hawks have teamed up again and again to create more crises, more regime changes, some done violently, some done, as in the case of Ukraine, done more through a political uprising with some violence. But, you know, so you have a mix of how it's done. But this idea of constantly doing regime changes in different countries has generated multiple failed states and increased tensions and caused refugee problems, and gotten a lot of people killed at a great expense.
Well, it's interesting how the mainstream, the Republicans, the mainstream media have tried to shift the blame for Iraq on Obama for not maintaining U.S. occupation, never mentioning the thing that held that up was that the U.S. troops no longer have free rein to shoot Iraqi soldiers, Iraqi citizens, and would be tried, and that was they wouldn't get a status of forces agreement from the new Iraqi government.
And the status of forces agreement that was agreed to, as you know, was agreed to by George W. Bush, which was a set date for the final withdrawal of the U.S. forces. Now, that also then included, as you point out, that is even though Obama tried to negotiate some change in that to give American soldiers legal protection if they, you know, killed Iraqi civilians, that the Iraqi government refused to do it. So there's also, of course, the myth that comes into this, which Hillary Clinton has accepted, which is the so-called myth of the successful surge. And that became another groupthink back in 2007, 2008, which was that because Bush sent in 30,000 extra American soldiers, that won the day, victory at last, Newsweek wrote. Well, but it wasn't victory at last. The surge was really a failure. It didn't achieve what it had set out to do, which was to provide time for the Shia and Sunnis to reconcile. That didn't happen, as we know. And it really didn't, and many of the reasons that the violence subsided somewhat related to things that were done prior to the surge. In 2006, for instance, by Generals Abizaid and Casey, who actually favored, along with Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, by the way, they favored a smaller footprint. They said the United States has to start pulling back. We can't continue this approach because it's not going to help resolve these differences between the Iraqis themselves. So they favored reducing the U.S. footprint. But they also did carry out like the killing of Zarqawi and other leaders of Al Qaeda in Iraq. They were involved in helping to separate the Shia and Sunni to a great extent. They started the so-called Sunni awakening by paying off Sunni tribal leaders so they would stop shooting at Americans.
Robert,
so a lot of stuff was done prior to the surge.
There's so much to talk about. We've come down to the end of the hour. How do people read what you have written, and how do they reach Consortium News?
Well, it's just a website. It's consortiumnews.com, and people can go there. And we have a lot of really good writers and people that know a great deal. Ironically, a number of former CIA analysts write for us. So we have a mix of journalists and people with deep experience in how the U.S. government functions.
And you founded that 20 years ago.
20 years ago, right?
Well, congratulations. Thank you, Robert Perry, for being our guest today and illuminating the problems. We haven't solved them, but at least you shed some light on them. Thanks so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.